Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Right, let's get into the news stories of today. And there's quite a few interesting things going on all over the place to do with the G20. And I think this story here has some strong connections to our story yesterday. Yesterday, we reported on the Sunday statement from the Gauteng provincial government, massively overreacting to some incidents of vandalism of signs welcoming people to the G20, which is set to take place soon across South Africa. But the most recent development has been that the lobby group Solidarity put up a big banner on the M1. I think this, based on the picture, it looks like very close to where Wits University is, those bridges. Wits University, which said, "Welcome to the most race-regulated country in the world." And then it had the Solidarity logo on either side. This, however, wasn't up for very long. After it went viral on social media, after being put up, it was extremely quickly taken down. Now, it's not entirely clear who took it down. It seems to have been the Metro Police in Joburg or possibly the Joburg government. But I did notice yesterday that Panyaza Lesufi's Twitter was posting a picture of it being taken down with the words "gone" and then tagging social media influencers in it. He also then subsequently tweeted, "You can mobilize your constituency as you wish," referring to Solidarity, "but that will not change your anti-transformation agenda. I am not a product of cowards, racists, or mindless, useless, and selfish. Bring it on." In response to this, Solidarity has said that they are considering legal action against the city of Johannesburg for taking down their advert. The advert was very clearly, I think, meant to be a kind of trolling to irritate the government by talking about race laws in South Africa. Their head of international relations, Solidarity's head of international relations, said they had paid for the advertising space and followed all the necessary procedures to run their awareness campaign. "Since government refuses to engage us about race laws and racial discrimination against minorities in South Africa, we've decided to launch a campaign during the G20 summit to make the rest of the world aware of the fact that South Africa is the most racially regulated country in the world." They said that they had received confirmation that the Joburg Metro Police Department had taken it down, saying its removal was unlawful. "We are going to approach the court for an urgent interdict. Our legal team is working on it. In the meantime, we will be putting up more similar banners across Gauteng over the next few days." So, Terence, I think the first question here is, and this really echoes with our theme of yesterday, is the sort of insecurity about all of this, right? Like, oh no, they can't possibly embarrass us. Quick, quick, take down the sign. And it's interesting how much the sort of prestige of the G20 is really like embedded itself in the minds of the Gauteng and Joburg governments, that they're going to such great efforts here. So what's your sort of first take on all of this?
Okay, as I said, this is like trolling, but with a smartphone the size of Gauteng. Now, I would say that there is a feature of the South African state, and here I'm referring to, let's say, its political arm, and particularly as it's been dominated by the ANC. But like the sort of classical god Janus, you know, with one face pointing in this direction, other face pointing in that direction. On the one hand, there's the outward facing one, the one that talks about rainbow nations, constitutional governance, friend to all the world. South Africa belongs to all who live in it. You know, this is called South Africa at its best. On the other hand, there is a face that looks typically inward, which is the one that praises Robert Mugabe, which is the one that sings, and in the case of the president, resolutely refuses to condemn Kill the Boer, darkly warns about people's futures and is paranoid about counter-revolution. Now, these two things sit very unevenly. It always strikes me when I speak to foreign diplomats. They often turn to this theme about South Africa having a unique history of dialogue and, overcoming differences. I'm saying, yeah, you know, there've been moments in South Africa's history when it's done that, but you're not going to hear the ANC talking in those terms in South Africa. They see that as a, I'll talk about the negotiations, not as a triumph of negotiation and compromise, but as a victory where negotiations were but a terrain of struggle. Now, this is something which I think Solidarity has a kind of pain point that Solidarity has pressed down on. It wants to hold up this view of the inward facing South Africa, let's say the ugly South Africa, up to foreign visitors, to at least leave them with a view that not all is well in South Africa. Now, I don't know how much impact that will have. I mean, there's more than a few countries that have sort of preferential policies in one way or another, and who knows, maybe this isn't something that will have much of an impact. But I do think it has an impact for the ANC and for the governments that it's responsible for. This disrupts a very a narrative that it is built particularly for external consumption. And as you say, I think that there is an enormous sense of insecurity. It is no longer the colossus bestriding the earth. And it also finds itself in a bit of a catch-22, because yes, you would like to banish this or wish it away or whatever, but first of all, you no longer have that sort of electoral political dominance. Secondly, your own performance has been, let's say, insalubrious. Go off the beaten track, and your French or Chinese delegate is going to be able to see, Johannesburg in all its raw potholed glory. And I'm pretty sure a couple of them will, want to go and, see the sights and sounds of Johannesburg. We are also a free society, and people get to say these sort of things. There is no great consensus. For a long time, I think the ANC could coast on the idea that because of its electoral dominance, because of its sort of assumed moral position, its voice counted. A party document said it's the most important moral voice on any issue facing the country. I mean, I think even its own supporters would laugh at that suggestion now. Well, welcome to competitive politics. If you're going to try and dismiss and ignore concerns, which are real, whatever one may think of them, then in an open society, you can find various ways to do this. And one of them is putting up big paid advertisements on the sides of highways.
I think there's a sort of kind of interesting tension in the ANC's commitment to these sort of racial policies, right? Because officially the ANC, commits itself to non-racialism. And as you say, they have cultivated this image of the sort of rainbow nation and stuff to the outside world. But at the same time, they also have this very strong race nationalist streak, right? We must, we are the authentic representatives of black people, specifically black people in South Africa. And, we're on this sort of heroic struggle. And the way they've always kind of squared this is by sort of, in a way, they sort of frame the race policies as being ultimately temporary. Now, they don't say that they, there's any imminent sunset clause in these things, but they when you kind of press them on it, they'll say, well, when the country is equal, when everyone of every race is equal, then we will get rid of these laws. And I think therein actually kind of lies the seeds of this sort of insecurity, which is that they have to admit that this is not in of itself a good, that the racial discrimination is not in of itself a good. It's only a justifiable evil to reach some sort of, utopian end goal. And, they put that goal as sufficiently utopian that we'll never actually reach it. So these things can continue forever. But I think you know, there's a sort of way that that moments like this kind of expose the sort of insecurity there, which is that they're not sort of entirely proud and comfortable always defending these policies. I think they're always like they're always kind of framed almost as a sort of pragmatic measure. I don't know. Do you think I'm barking up the wrong tree there? What's your take on that?
Look, I think it depends. It depends who you are talking to and in what context. You know, you mentioned race nationalism. I think that there's something which has not been sufficiently recognized in our politics, that the ANC is fundamentally a nationalist organization. And the way nationalist movements have worked in South Africa, whether it's English jingo nationalism or Afrikaner nationalism, is they have tended to kind of follow a sort of ethnic or a racial path. Now, let me just say, I would say solidarity fits very, you know, fits within the Afrikaner nationalist tradition. And I think that, you know, there's something there that that the ANC finds particularly grating, because it's, you know, African and Afrikaner nationalisms, you know, fought ferociously in the 20th century. Before that, it was sort of British and Boer nationalisms. And you know, there's the sense that that this is an existential that there is an existential conflict. But that's not, and that's something I think that, you know, many people in the ANC would be quite happy advertising within the country, you know, particularly since they have a very strong part of their constituency has benefited very well off those policies. And by the way, I remember, I think a former Minister of Labour, I was going back to 2005, gave an estimate of we'll need three generations. In other words, this is beyond the lifespan of, you know, of anyone watching. So it's never, but that's effectively saying it'll, you know, we're never going to repeal this. Whereas that doesn't work well when you are trying to present yourself as a, you know, human rights oriented constitutional state that extends equal citizenship, and that is, above all, the moral superior of the nationalist waves that have come before you. Now, I would say, in contrast to both British and Boer nationalism or British and Afrikaner nationalism, African nationalism, you know, did not disenfranchise anyone. And, you know, these are important distinctions to be made. But there is still the sense that, you know, we represent one group implicitly and sometimes explicitly against and to the exclusion of others. In a plural society like South Africa, that's not likely to be a productive or, you know, ultimately beneficial course of action.
Yeah, no, and this is the sort of theme that runs through so much of our politics. But, you know, once again, I think the insecurity here is rather amusing. And if indeed it turns out that Solidarity did follow all of the legal guidelines and paid their money and there's absolutely no legal basis for taking them down, I suspect the courts will rule against the government, and then it's going to be embarrassing and possibly costly. So this kind of rash, panicky behavior is very likely to come back and bite the Gauteng government, or the Joburg government rather, on its behind. We'll keep an eye on this to see what happens. Okay, let's turn from talking about the ANC to talking about the DA. So it emerged in the media that the DA's Minister of Forestry, Fisheries and Environmental Affairs, I think is the portfolio's name, Minister Dion George, has apparently on the chopping block, that for a while now, John Steenhuisen has actually made the request to Cyril Ramaphosa to remove him as minister and replace him with another DA appointee. So that's quite interesting. And what's very interesting is to see how all the different factions at play are playing this out in the media. So the classic way of when you do an internal shuffle to get rid of someone in a political move is different sides will leak narratives to the media anonymously in the hopes that they'll be published, and then they'll sort of say, this is the real reason I was fired. And we're seeing that play out kind of beautifully here. Well, he hasn't been removed yet because President Ramaphosa apparently is, I think, in Europe or something. And hasn't been able to do it yet. But here are some of the headlines that you've got, and you can see the factions. So just a point on factions, I want to say that it doesn't matter what political movement you're looking at. You can relook at the ANC, the DA, the IFP, the Labour Party in Britain, the Republican or the Democratic Party in America, the Chinese Communist Party. Every political party has factions. And even if you can't see them, they're there, and they're maneuvering against each other under the scenes. And you can really see it here. So here are some headlines that are clearly favorable to Dion George in the Daily Maverick. One reads, "The sacking of Dion George, how progressive ministers being taken down by the wildlife breeders." And here's another headline from a different article. "Steenhuisen's lion bone gambit, firing of the one minister who finally took on the wildlife trade." And just reading a little bit from that article. "Agriculture Minister John Steenhuisen wants President Cyril Ramaphosa to fire the Ministry of Forestry, Fisheries and Environment, Dion George, and replace him with DA National Spokesperson Willy Aukamp. On paper, it looks like the reshuffle request in a fragile government of national unity. In reality, it looks like a calculated move to drag the environment portfolio back into the arms of South Africa's powerful hunting and wildlife trade lobby. Strip away the spin, and the timing is impossible to ignore. George is the first environment minister in years to meaningfully move against South Africa's shameful captive lion industry and associated lion bone trade." Let's turn, however, to Business Day for a very different story. The real story behind Dion George's sacking. "Forestry and Fisheries Minister Dion George was rude and abusive to his staff, an untenable situation that resulted in his party asking President Ramaphosa to axe him from the cabinet," DA insiders say. "On numerous occasions, Minister George made deeply inappropriate remarks, including comments about driving staff to suicide and referring to them as weak-minded. These were not isolated incidents, but part of a broader pattern of intimidation and psychological mistreatment. Many long-serving employees, individuals served the department faithfully for decades under multiple principals, reached out in tears, stating they could no longer endure the conditions under his leadership. The level of distress among staff was unprecedented," said the source. Here's what I suspect is probably a little bit closer to the actual reason. "A cabinet colleague told Business Day it was clear the minister would not listen to anyone, including his party's leaders. Other than refusing to abide by DA decisions, he disregarded cabinet decisions, which are legally binding on all ministers. He exposed the DA and cabinet by withdrawing legal action around a mining exploration case that undermined the cabinet's mandate. That was a big blunder and upset many people and gave the impression that the DA's ministers were a law unto themselves. DA leader John Steenhuisen said that George was being demoted after rejecting the party's request to serve as Deputy Trade, Industry and Competition Minister to replace Andrew Whitfield, who was fired. The trade and industry portfolio is one of the most important, and Dion George is a US citizen, which could have helped relations. It was unusual that he would refuse, and I am disappointed because he would have been excellent in that portfolio. There have been consequences," Steenhuisen said in an interview. So, a lot here, I've just said, Terence. For what it's worth, I think that, you know, Dion George's policies, from what I understood of them, were not particularly conducive, I think, to the goals of economic growth. You know, I think that we need industries, we need the hunting industry, we need the captive lion industry, things like that, provide jobs, money, tourism, et cetera, to this country. So if indeed that was the reason he was being fired, then I think that's a good reason to actually fire him. You know, we need economic growth and development in this country. But it is fascinating to see these completely different versions that different factions are putting out into the media. And, you know, it actually makes me think that this is kind of how politics is done in a healthy democracy. Are we perhaps maturing into a fully developed state when everyone is doing anonymous leaks to the media to take down their opponents? What's your take on all of this?
Look, I would rather people are doing anonymous leaks and shooting each other in the shadows, which does happen in our great constitutional republic. So yeah, you know, better that than the alternative. Look, I think that what you're seeing here is a kind of Rorschach test response, where you know, everyone can attribute whatever interpretation they want, because no one really knows. So my own intuition is that this probably had to do with a falling out, between Dion George and the sort of party's leadership more broadly. Maybe I'm right. Maybe I'm wrong. But yes, the idea that it was all about captive lion breeding or whatever, I think it says a lot more about the this particular analyst's views on these things than about reality. Or yeah, unless of course they can show some sort of insider knowledge. I also did find the commentary on dual citizenship interesting. My understanding is that Dion George lived in the United States for a while. Right. So I think there are many people who would find it a little jarring if Minister of a Government was to enter another country using that country's travel document. But I heard that the president of Colombia was saying, well, you know, America can ban him, but he's also an Italian citizen, so which, you know, there you've got the head of state holding the citizenship of another country. But that is that's an interesting factor in this world, that those sort of overlapping affiliations are common, not least in South Africa. Those with long memories might recall that the first Speaker of Parliament after 1994, Frien Ginwala, was kind of outed for holding a British passport. And she gave this completely ridiculous explanation that she contacted the British High Commission because she was going to Europe and she wanted to know about Schengen visas. And so they just sent her a passport. I don't know. It seems to me you actually have to fill in forms, submit photographs. And why she was approaching the British High Commission about going to mainland Europe is, you know, I also seem to remember Barney Pachana, another, head of the Human Rights Commission and major proponent of Africanism in thought, word, and deed, you know, declaring casually at a press conference that he holds a British passport and finds South Africa's jurisprudence much more advanced and progressive. There was also, funnily enough, a case where just prior to the transition, a member of the Pan-Africanist Congress was arrested and was visited by the Australian High Commissioner because it turns out he was an Australian citizen. Strange things happen in this new South Africa, as someone once said.
Yes. This is kind of a sort of fascinating story to see what is, this internal politics playing out behind the scenes. And I think this is probably, you know, possibly going to be a good move for the DA. I mean, look, ultimately, once you've released anonymous reporting that, says that this guy had become a quote-unquote monster when he became minister, like, at that point, the knives are out and cannot be sheathed, and it's it's sort of a fight to the death, right? Like, that's a kind of comment that, destroys relationships and reputations. I mean, I'm sure Dion George probably has an idea of who maybe said that or has suspicions about who maybe said that, and you can see that it's going to be very difficult to mend any sort of relationship there. So that's quite vicious and brutal. And it's also a reminder that, the DA too has its factions, and they are they are fighting and have different ideas and visions for the party. Anyway, I think that's a story we'll also keep an eye on. We'll see if there is indeed a major policy difference with the new minister. All right. Let's go back to talk about G20 stuff. When you kind of go deep into the circles of some of the most sort of, I guess you could call them fever swampy parts of the ANC and its extended universe. And by that, I mean also the EFF and the MK. There's a lot of paranoia about the CIA and the Americans being behind this or that. And I think that it's clear that some people in the ANC definitely think that Solidarity and various other groups. I mean, maybe even us or the IRR are sort of the agents of the CIA who are working to derail the National Democratic Revolution or something. We're not that well funded, so they don't have to worry that much. But the this can only be heightened with recent comments from Donald Trump when he said on Truth Social towards the end of last week, he said, quote, excuse me, "It's a total disgrace that the G20 will be held in South Africa. Afrikaners, brackets, people who are descended from Dutch settlers and also French and German immigrants, close brackets, are being killed and slaughtered and their land and farms being illegally confiscated. No US government official will attend as long as these human rights abuses continue. I look forward to hosting the 2026 G20 in Miami, Florida." So apart from just saying the things that he said in the past about Afrikaners and the genocide and human rights abuses and all that, this is kind of final confirmation that despite much speculation that Trump or at least someone high ranking from the US government would show up at the G20, it doesn't look like that's going to happen. Terrence, your thoughts on all of this? I mean, you know, I'm always very frustrated by some of this stuff because, like, you know, obviously, expropriation without compensation, the expropriation bill or the expropriation act, we have very serious problems with this. We think they're damaging to our constitutional order. But Trump's description of them is not right. And I don't know. What do you think? Do you think the G20 is still going to have the sort of importance that it would normally have with the Americans not there?
No. Look, the point about the G20 is that it's not a sort of formally constituted treaty-based or, you know, established institution. It's a group of countries that sort of freely associate. And the idea behind it was that it this incorporated the largest economies in the world. Initially, it actually came out of the G7, and was initially focused on dealing with the financial crises in the 1990s. And I think it was in 2007, if I'm not mistaken, under George W. Bush, that they turned it into the G20 and started to, you know, made it a kind of an organization that would have these summits amongst heads of state. And South Africa was sort of brought in because it was kind of the most together African country, and it's big on its global role. But if you want these sort of global solutions, particularly on economic matters, you just have to have the Americans. Any other country, possibly with the exception of China, is probably dispensable. Although you'd want them, but without America, no. Look, the other problem is that what are the decisions of a group like this really mean anyway? Because they can't really be enforced. They depend on countries voluntarily, committing and voluntarily, bringing the necessary resources. Otherwise, it kind of becomes a joint statement or, something that isn't particularly meaningful or impactful. Here you've got America saying that it explicitly won't cooperate with South Africa. Where I might take issue is I'm not sure just how successful the G20 in Miami is going to be, because I don't think that these sort of multinational fora are things that Donald Trump is particularly interested in. Right. He seems far more to be far more about bilateral relationships.
He did say some positive things about the NATO summit when he went there. So I don't know, maybe the G20 nations have, or maybe that warmed him up to these sort of events.
Possibly, although I would argue that NATO represents a an arrangement where the US does get certain benefits, and also those are countries that are that have generally been its historical allies.
Right, and it's an actual thing. It's, you know, it's a it's, as you say, it's a treaty organization that exists. Yeah. Whereas the G20 is like, you know, there's just collection of countries. Just for interest's sakes, to those who don't know, here's the list of G20 countries: South Africa, Argentina, Australia, Brazil, Canada, China, the European Union, France, Germany, India, Indonesia, Italy, Japan, South Korea, Mexico, Russia, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, UK, and the USA. So it's sort of like a little bit of an arbitrary list, right? Because not all of those countries are necessarily in the same weight category. I mean, South Africa and Argentina do not compare to India or Saudi Arabia or even Turkey, I think.
Right. No, certainly. South Africa, in a sense, slipped through a crack in history. It happened to be there. An okay country at the right time in the right place. Remember, this was still under, when Thabo Mbeki was, whatever his faults, was able to speak to leaders across the board. South Africa hadn't declined to the state it is now. I genuinely don't think that a great deal will come out of this, or was ever going to. But it is one of those things that animates our governing class. So yeah, we shall see. And you know, and I think in that sense, the sort of Trump beating this drum at this time, has found a pain point for South Africa's government, because it is particular. It values its global reputation. You know, there is a sort of implied link between Solidarity's posters or Solidarity's banners and Trump's tweets. Both of them, speak to issues that the South African government is not particularly keen to talk about. And I'll say this. While I agree wholeheartedly that Trump's thoughts on these things and his expression have not been helpful, I despaired when I saw the first one, because there's a certain type of, call it a progressive, you know, for whom the ability to fight Trump is truly an almost auto-erotic experience. It doesn't take things forward. But you know, they it sort of opens up a front that the government feels it needs to fight. So, you know, it ends up, you know, sometimes quite bizarrely, you know, entering the lists to, you know, argue that it's not targeted at white people. We're just slaughtering each other in general. But I will say this in conclusion: South Africa still has no ambassador in Washington. So, you know, over this year, when the country was hosting the G20. You know, it's big. You know, one of its flagship of, you know, events. Probably a bigger thing globally than anything since the World Cup. And while the relationship with the US has been circling the toilet bowl, apparently water circles in different directions in the northern and southern hemisphere. Just a fun fact. There is no senior diplomat there. So yes, you know, Trump has not been helpful, but I think it takes a special kind of ineptitude to respond the way that the South African authorities have.
You know, I'm reminded in all this about in talking about the sort of G20 and the insecurity of the ANC around it. That famous exchange in the South African Parliament years ago when Helen Suzman was asking these difficult questions of the apartheid government's apartheid government. And, you know, she was accused by a national party member of embarrassing the country. And she replied, it's not my questions that are embarrassing you, it's your answers. And I think some of that is coming up here, which is that, you know, the ANC is feeling insecure and embarrassed perhaps by some of these things because it has things to be insecure and embarrassed about. That it can't manage these relationships, that crime is out of control, that it is indeed trying to undermine property rights, that it has a record of service delivery failure, that it has managed poor economic growth. Were we a thriving country with a booming mining sector, decreasing unemployment every single year, the ANC wouldn't be so insecure. And I think this is all a reflection of the fact that their political position, as you said at the beginning, has just, the colossus is very much on shaky ground.
Yep, absolutely.
As indeed was the real colossus at Rhodes, which fell over due to an earthquake. But let's not get bogged down in that one. Anyway, thank you very much for watching. We hope you found the show interesting, and we'll be back tomorrow with the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a wonderful day. The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.